All right. Well, hello there, Rupert. How are you? And welcome to News of the Money World. How are you doing?
Afternoon. I'm very good. Exciting night. Big changes happening in the world. Big changes happening in financial markets.
I know.
It's been a fascinating 48, 72 hours as we're trying to guess where it goes to. I'm not going to lie. I was surprised.
You were you? Man, I was totally.
Yeah, I was actually.
I was like, yeah, that's pretty much what I thought. I was watching the Poly Market stats, and this is the first time I've kind of looked at that, and I thought, okay, I kind of understand how it's probably accurate because people are putting their money behind it, but it's relatively new, and I don't really fully understand how it works. But I did kind of understand towards the end that the closer that we got towards the election results, the more accurate those Poly Market readings were be. And I don't know. I kind of thought that maybe it was 50-50, that it could go either way. But then, yeah, throughout the day, having a look at the price of Bitcoin in particular, that kind of gave it away. You know, it was like, because efficient market hypothesis, right? The price of any asset takes into account all known information. So that's exactly what we saw. But it is kind of surprising, though, that the reaction from one side is very much in disbelief. Like, not your disbelief, but I'm talking about extreme disbelief. How could this possibly happen? And I wonder, just like, be keen to hear your views around this, because you're probably a bit more balanced than I am in this area, Rupert. But from a balance point of view, how do you feel media, either in the US, like I'm talking mainstream media here, versus New Zealand, how do you feel the coverage was there? Because I kind of feel like maybe that's responsible for some of the surprise.
I think the media is responsible for a lot of the reaction that we've been getting, right? I mean, as we probably all know, I read The Economist, and The Economist wrote it. Couple of thousand words last week about how dangerous Donald Trump would be for the world and what a disaster it would be for him coming in, right? I mean, Bloomberg, which is my other media that I spend a lot of time on, they were pretty anti as well. And I think everyone seemed to be pretty anti. They were wrong, I don't know, but it was pretty hard to get a balanced view. And then, I mean, probably my biggest disappointment was here in New Zealand, right? We're waking up this morning to the Herald. Or actually, it was kind of everything is super negative, right? This is terrible for New Zealand. This is terrible for the world. This is world's most dangerous place ever now. And it's kind of like, it's just not necessary. Markets have clearly telling us what they think about it. When the S&P 500 is up 2.5% last night, global markets actually ended flat. So it wasn't negative as everyone had anticipated. I kind of go, yeah, I'm not seeing the balance. It feels as though we've taken a view that this guy's horrible. It's the only thing we want to talk about, and anything related to him is a disaster. And I'm not sticking up for his behavior. I'm not a fan at all of Donald Trump. We've completely missed the point by focusing all of our attention on him and kind of his behavior versus actually what he represents.
Sure. I think, though, that this is kind of symptomatic of the last 4 to 5 years in particular, though, where you can choose to take your cues from mainstream media and trust that they have done the due diligence. But we just keep on getting reminders that they're not doing due diligence very well. They're not being unbiased. They do have a tilt. And it kind of feeds into probably some of the firepower or some of the reasons why Trump got in like he did. And I just wonder if it's kind of all connected, right? Like this distrust of mainstream media because of the fact that they've been biased on a few really key issues over the last few years, or not truthful. And just that feeling that a lot of participants in the economy kind of feel like they've got the short end of the stick and no one's really sticking up for them. They're sticking up for their projects and their initiatives and mandates, but they're not actually sticking up for the everyday person. And that can go on for so long until people fight back. And that's the cool thing with democracy, is that every now and then we get reminded that it still exists. It's not dead yet. And that's actually really encouraging, I think. And so when I was talking to my kids about this last night, as I was letting them watch some of the results, kind of like 50-50, flopping back and forth who they supported, we were having a bit of fun with it. But I'm just trying to explain to them that, you know, every decision that we make in life has hopefully good elements to it, but then it also comes with the potential for some bad results as well. And our job really is to just make the best decisions that we possibly can, knowing that there's no perfect people, no perfect solutions. You really just kind of have to think about the money, right? At the end of the day, you have to kind of think, how does it actually affect my portfolio? And hence this podcast.
Well, look, unfortunately, that's how I woke up this morning. On one hand, you went, hey, look, Donald Trump's probably not great for the world in the long run. He's amazing for my business. My cryptocurrency fund will now go nuts, and my US equity fund will now go nuts. And it is a really hard one, right? And I think it puts a lot of the decisions in perspective, in my mind at least, as well, because so often when we make these decisions and when we kind of think about it, the difference is kind of blended and you can't quite see the correlation. Whereas here, I can very firmly see financially, if a Trump win, we'll be better off. But kind of broader social and probably super long-term, worse off. And it's really interesting. It's very rare in life that you have those kind of complete juxtapositions next to each other.
Yeah, I know. So let's just have a chat about parallels and stuff like that. And then we'll get into just how it might affect certain key markets like crypto and equities and bonds in particular, because I think there's an interesting story there. But what's your view generally around any potential parallel between Donald Trump's potential term going forward here and what would it look like for Boris Johnson in the UK and how that panned out for him? Do you see those things as similar things that we can kind of use as a reference point?
I kind of do, actually, because I think it's really interesting. So Boris Johnson came in, when was his election? So they've just done it now. So it must have been 2019, because every 5 years. Came in, the biggest majority of the Conservatives have ever won, super popular, just delivered Brexit, came in with this whole separatist message. I mean, the other thing about the UK system, under the UK system, you do have absolute power, because it's similar to New Zealand, where it's basically the single house. And it just turned into an absolute debacle. And you saw very quickly how the public, everyone kind of moved against them and moved pretty quickly to disliking it. It just led to that continual churn of prime ministers in the UK. I do have to wonder, right? We've had Boris Johnson come in. I mean, sorry, we've had Donald Trump come in, got the whitewash. He's got the red sweep has been complete. So now he's got the Congress, he's got the Senate, he's packed out the Supreme Court. He's basically all seeing, all doing, all powerful. I think he's probably still incompetent, and I still think he's probably going to be slightly chaotic. And so you do have to wonder as to how long does it actually last, and is there kind of a whole lot of other stuff that kind of goes on in between times. But the flip side, though, is, again, exactly the same as what we've just seen with Labour in the UK. They came in, how long have they been there? Kind of 5-6 months already?
Yeah.
And what's fascinating about that is, again, they just went on the "we are not the Tories" mandate. They've had no idea what to do, and already it's turning into a disaster. So, yeah, so it's kind of really interesting, this politics that we're starting to play, right? And I think there's a lot of analogies where Kamala Harris ran on a campaign which had nothing to do with policy. It was just basically, "I'm not Donald Trump." And that didn't quite work. And you do see the risk of that happening again. But, yeah, it is pretty interesting, right? I do think that the UK is probably 3 or 4 years ahead of America in this trend.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. But it's a world, like a worldwide phenomenon that we seem to have more polarization going on, right? Like, I personally don't see our current prime minister in New Zealand as polarizing as the previous one. And by polarizing, I mean people that are really passionately for and passionately against. We definitely had that with Jacinda Ardern. Whether we have that with the current prime minister, I know we have those that are passionately against, but I don't know if those that are for the current prime minister are that passionate about it. Maybe they're just not passionate people. I don't know. I'm not that excited about it.
I don't think anyone's passionately for him. But I do think, again, in New Zealand, we do need to be mindful that our politics has also become very divisive, right? We're in a world now where we're very quick to dismiss anything from the past. So, I mean, you look at since they've come in, and we're almost 12 months since that government kind of came in. Actually, at this stage, they haven't done anything. All they've done is spent the last 12 months dismantling everything that Labor did, putting it through into a new committee to figure out what they're going to do next. I mean, that's not helpful. There hasn't even been a willingness to look at anything that was done positively in the past. And don't get me wrong, there was some dumb shit that was done that did need to be unwound, but there's a lot of stuff that feels as though it's just been unwound for the sake of it. And so, as much as I don't think the supporters, and particularly not the current Prime Minister's supporters, are as passionate as what we see offshore, I do think our politics is becoming very, very, very similar, right? Highly oppositional, very much about, actually, this is all about me, I've got my turn now, and I'm going to get as much done as quickly as I can, and fuck off, basically.
Yeah. So it's a risk, right? So when I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about this long term. Say if I was in my, for example, if I was in my late 40s, which I just happen to be for this example, and I had 15 years ago to retire, right? Well, 15 years feels like a really long time these days because of just all of the intense, crazy stuff that we've seen in the last 5 years even. And the thought of three times as much of that in the next 15, like, scares me, right? Because I want to know what it's going to look like. Are we going to have a situation where the pendulum swings really far to the right now as a reaction to how far things were going to the left? And as a result of going extremely to the right, does the left rise up with even more vengeance and really take it even further next time with the same thing happening on the right? And because if that happens, then it becomes really hard to predict and to model the impact of volatility. Because what's going to happen with taxes? Will we have capital gains tax or a wealth tax within the next 15 years? And I'd say, hey, the more extreme things get, the more likely that becomes a yes. And are we going to get things like inflation completely going ballistic and out of control again? And I'd say the more likely to be yes if we have politicians that are introducing more extreme policies or undoing things too fast. And I think that kind of really brings us back to the US and Donald Trump. Like, he's talking about some significant changes, right? Tariffs, taxes, deregulation as three big economic issues or things that he's going to tackle really seriously. That's going to be kind of disruptive and hopefully in a good way. But again, any good decision comes with a potential for a bad outcome too. So what are your views firstly on tariffs, specifically what it means for the US and then maybe what it means for New Zealand as well?
Tariffs are bad, no question on it, right? They are a tax on consumers. Do end up getting paid by the consumers at the end of the day, right? Because it's a cost that's gone into the cost of goods. And much as the producers might wear some of it in their margins, there's only so long that they can go on for, right? And particularly with a lot of the stuff coming from offshore, where it is highly competitive, at the end of the day, it helps US producers. It definitely hurts US consumers, and there's far more consumers than there are producers. The impact of the tariffs, actually, though, it's kind of, I've done some interesting reading on this, won't be as big as you kind of assume, right? Because, I mean, we've even seen it over the last couple of weeks, right? Where US dollar is actually about 6-7% stronger than where it was a couple of weeks ago. So already a kind of the global tariff, the non-Chinese tariff, that's almost dealt with that, right? So you've basically kind of...
Yeah, good point.
I've already dealt with that there, right? So,
yeah.
But I do think we kind of, they will be inflationary. They probably aren't going to slow demand as much as everyone's kind of saying in the US because of the exchange rate, some of the other impacts of where it gets. It will be a reorganization of trade. Be kind of, I think China will be very nervous about what's happening right now because there's not only has there been the talk of exporting from China, there's a recognition that they now need to shut down Vietnam because things were going from China to Vietnam back to the US to get through tariff-free. Mexico's, you saw the Mexican peso dropped about 3% overnight as a result of that because that's going to be another net loser. So it's kind of unfortunately creating this world of winners and losers, and personally don't think there will be any winners. Second point around New Zealand. New Zealand's really interesting, right? So New Zealand, about 15% of our merchant exports, so the things that we send offshore, currently we're going to go to the US. But when I look at that, a huge amount of that is actually, it's kind of dairy, meat, wine, all those kind of the traditional agricultural goods that we're pretty good at sending offshore. Hate to say it, most of that's already subject to tariffs. So that's why it's going to be hard. There might be additional tariffs over and above what is currently being done because you've got to remember the US are very protective of their worlds, their agricultural world and their agricultural producers. So look, doubt it, to be perfectly honest. Not going to be a huge amount in my mind that comes through. I mean, you look at China, you look at other markets who have been subject to the tariffs, they continue to truck on. It is what it is. And we just need to focus on how do we deal with it? How do we work in that world versus kind of continuing to sit there moaning about it? Great quote from Don Braid today, who's the CEO of Main Freight. He came out saying, you know what? Tariffs and this whole kind of Trump world is really good for my business because everyone's going to try as hard as they can to export as much as they can before the tariffs come in. Everyone's now in a rush. It's going to create demand through our economy. That's going to be a good impetus to get stuff done. Yeah. So let's look at the positive sides of it versus the negative.
Good on him. That's good. And I guess like the other element of this in terms of how it could affect New Zealand, I'm pretty sure the US is like the third largest export market for New Zealand goods. Could be wrong.
Yeah.
But it's like something like $5 or $6 billion in terms of goods, $2 billion in terms of services. So it's not insignificant. But I kind of look at this from the point of view of, firstly, what happens if they cut some sort of trade deal with Australia, but not New Zealand? That's a possibility, right? Like that's a risk. But
they already have though. They've already got an FTA with Australia versus us.
Well, that was quick. That was probably before I realized it.
No. But that's kind of part of it though, right? Like I remember when that FTA got brought in, this must have been 15 years ago, not longer. I was like, oh, well, that's the death of New Zealand. New Zealand exporters are never going to survive if we don't have that free trade agreement.
Yeah.
But we did.
Yeah.
15 years later, and our exports are still growing at 5-6% a year.
Yeah. But I mean, like, what happens if we get laden with more tariffs, but they don't? And I guess it's that relative difference that I wonder about. But also, if we think about the really weird and awkward situation that we have where our security partner lies in the West, but our trading partner is in the East, and surely it's in the US's best interest if they're going to start getting nasty with China, for example, surely they're going to help New Zealand out and any trading partner really in the West, so that there's more of an economic and security package going on here. I don't know enough about this, but I'm keen to know, like, do you have any perspective around that? Like, do you think that this could, because the changing global order and China's rise surely must be of concern to the US, not just from a trading perspective, but from a from a military point of view. I think the Thucydides trap, I can't pronounce that word, is at play here, where the dominant power is threatened by the rising power. And I just wonder if that might change how these tariffs work, in that the tariffs are more applied towards the countries that the US is a little bit not happy with anyway. Do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah, I mean, that's a logical argument. And that was Kamala's argument as well. The problem is with Donald Trump, logic doesn't always win. As viewers, there's a winner and a loser in every single transaction, and he just wants to be the winner. I mean, I do think, personally, I think actually the pressure comes the other way, right? I actually think for us in New Zealand, the pressure is going to come from China. And I think that you are right. We do have a massive issue where we have security relationship with the US. Now, all of our trading relationship is with China. It's the bit that kind of, I think, that is a massive risk. The flip side to that, though, is that most of that is agriculture. So most of it's milk, dairy, dairy, meat, and logs. Can't really get that from anywhere else. And so maybe that's why kind of we're actually all right. I mean, Australia have got a much worse relationship with China. The iron ore and coal exports, they still keep on going because China's not silly enough to cut off its face despite itself.
Yeah. Okay. So what about taxes then? So taxes are one of those. He's going to cut the corporate tax rate, provide a lot of relief there. That obviously could increase the net amount that people can earn by investing in companies if they're being taxed less. So surely that's going to create more competition, more economic activity, knowing that taking risk allows you to keep more of that gain. But at the same time, it creates more of an inflationary pressure. Maybe it's delayed, which then necessitates potentially higher interest rates to mop up the mess. So yeah, what's your view though on taxes? Like everybody loves lower taxes, but do you think that we're going to have some issues here if Donald Trump kind of goes hardcore and reduces taxes?
What's he said? So he said that he will extend his tax cuts. In 2017, he had his previous tax round where effectively a whole range of taxes got reduced, but the big one was bringing the corporate tax rate down from, I think it was 39% down to 21%. And actually, what he said is he wants to make those permanent because they're set to expire in late 2026. And he also wants to bring the corporate tax rate further down to 15%, which is kind of where the OECD has set. That's the minimum kind of tax rate that's kind of normal and fair and everyone should be charging. What do I think about that? Great for corporates. I think you look at Ireland. There's a great article there, like a couple of weeks ago. Ireland currently gone, over the last 15 years, they've gone from the basket case of Europe to being the strongest economy, running a 3-4% GDP deficit, surplus GDP, off the back of a low tax environment. Admittedly, it's also because they're on the doorstep to Europe, so you get easy access to Europe, and it's the one place that's left in the European Union that you've got Anglophone speaking. So that's why all the tech companies have gone and set up there. So that's the global example. Singapore is a global example as well that everyone thinks about. I do think, on merit, there might be a strong argument that very low corporate tax actually means that they will drive higher growth. Problem is, the US can't afford it. In the US, they have the debt of GDP is currently sitting at about 100%, or maybe 90%, sorry. I think if Trump enacts his proposals and does what he has said that he will do, particularly around those tax cuts, the number's going to grow to about 136% over the next 10 years, right? It's not entirely low versus kind of if you compare it with Japan, Italy, some of those other markets. Yeah, it's basically by enacting these tax cuts, you're recognizing that that kind of the US deficit is now permanent. What we have seen over the last 5 years, the bigger the deficit, the bigger the inflation as well. It does also mean that we've got higher interest rates. So on one hand, I see some benefits in the tax cuts around potential growth. I do have real concerns around what it does to the overall fiscal position in the US. I mean, at the end of the day, they are the reserve currency of the world, so they can push that a lot further than anyone else. And I doubt that it's actually going to cause too many big issues. But I do think it's inflationary, and I do think that it drives higher interest rates, which will be demand destruction on its own as well.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, there's a lot to be said, though, just around, hey, if the government can just print the currency, which they can, then do we even need taxes whatsoever? I'm taking the modern monetary policy.
You're taking the Weimar German view.
Yeah, the Weimar Republic. And I guess, and maybe that is why things like gold seem to spike when there's a loss of confidence in things here. But what we've seen recently over the last 24 hours is we've seen $100 come off the price of gold. Obviously, the price of gold is highly correlated with the market. Yeah. So maybe the market was actually pricing in an inability to control inflation and for things just to get way out of control. Or I don't know, but it seems like there was a premium attached to gold for the uncertainty that would have happened if Kamala got in versus Donald Trump.
Maybe they were playing on the uncertainty of a drawn out process.
Perhaps like a tighter race.
Yeah.
Civil unrest and all of the associated aftermath. Yeah, possibly, because it is quite interesting, because on the other hand, we have Bitcoin that we'll come back to in a second, but that's gone the other way, interestingly enough. But before we move on from just like the impacts of the economic impacts here, what about deregulation? And we've heard that there's going to be cuts everywhere. Elon Musk is joining the team and he's going to lead up the department of, I don't know what it's called again, but basically, he's going to strip out, kind of like what David Seymour is doing over here. It's quite interesting. Elon Musk is far more successful than our version of it here, I would venture to say. No disrespect, David. But yeah, you've got things like that, right? And I just wonder how much that will offset some of the corporate rate tax cuts. If there's less regulation as well, will that help? Where if the government shrinks,
but that's a long term, right? Because remember, deregulation supports investment, supports growth. It's kind of 5 years before that turns into actually anything real. So, right. And I hate to say this, but it will come at a cost, right? It will come at an environmental cost, and it will come at the cost of people. Again, so Elon, first two things that he wants to do is he's going to make it so that there's no regulation around self-driving cars. Not sure how keen I'm to be driving around in an environment where there's no regulation around self-driving cars. He's also talking about the fact that regulations around his space stuff is way too stringent, way too strict, and they should be allowed to they shouldn't have to tick the boxes they need to tick before they launch rockets into space, and they should just be allowed to do whatever they want. So no, right? It might unleash a new wave of growth. There will be some costs as well, right? One of the big examples they consistently bring up when they talk about deregulation is fossil fuels. Fracking, and they're going to make it easier to dig, and they're going to make it easier to for oil. The truth is, for the last 4 years, the US has pulled out more oil and gas than ever before. At the moment, they are pumping more oil than there's ever been pumped before, right? Which is why this in the Middle East doesn't really impact oil prices at the moment. So that's where I find it kind of quite an interesting dichotomy, right? Of going, the big area where I think Trump and a lot of other people are focused on is around that oil and gas and natural resources and some of that.
Yes.
That's happening anyway. It's pretty hard to imagine more happening. And then so then you move into the safety stuff, the environmental concerns, all of those things. And I get there needs to be a balance, but yeah, I am concerned about where that leads.
Yeah. Okay. So much more to talk about, including immigration and stuff like that I'd love to get into, but I think we probably need to keep moving. And I want to talk about maybe the four things in terms of the market, equities to start with. So you mentioned before, I think at the S&P 500 and NASDAQ, well, basically all the indexes were up. Bitcoin was up significantly. What is that saying? Is it saying that obviously market participants are looking through all of the noise now clearly and going, hey, well, this is clearly good for markets, for the economy. Is that what we're saying?
We're saying three things, right? So I think that there's probably two slightly different stories, the equity market story versus the crypto story. So let's start on the equity markets. Equity markets are seeing three things, right? They're seeing lower taxes. Lower taxes means higher profits. They're seeing deregulation, making it easier to do business. And then the third is they're seeing the end of the business unfriendly environment. So Joe Biden was very pro-union. Look at what's happening with Boeing right now in the US. He was very business unfriendly. So hard to get mergers through, hard to get stuff kind of truly done. And so I think there's a bit of celebration at the end of that. So to me, it's kind of those three things is what we've seen overnight. That's why we saw that 2.5% rally tonight, plus probably the 5 or 6% that's happened over the week leading up to that as well. Crypto, to be fair, is a slightly different story. Me, crypto, it's all about hold on a sec. We've finally got someone in the White House that's going to support us. It's going to make life better, right? Crypto. So Donald Trump, he's promised three things. He's promised that the US will stop selling crypto because the US is actually a big owner of crypto through DOJ, FBI, any kind of law enforcement activity is kind of generally where that's come from.
We should say Bitcoin instead of crypto though, right? Because I think that's probably the case. It's probably more Bitcoin.
Oh, sorry. You're right. It's Bitcoin. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's going to make Bitcoin and crypto, the regulatory approach, a whole lot easier. Previously, Mr. Fire, Gary Gensler, I doubt that'll happen, but there will at least be some instructions around, actually, you need to be more friendly. You need to be more pro-crypto. And that will kind of make it easier for people to develop new products, bring kind of access to Bitcoin to retail investors in the US. It's going to be a massive demand generation. Plus, he's kind of pledged to lodge a task force, which is all about actually how do we kind of really embrace crypto as the future of money? How do we make money better, simpler, use this technology for more purposes? And so I think why we get confident that this is more than just campaign talk. Well, there's two reasons. One is a huge amount of his campaign finances came from the crypto industry. Number two, he's also gone deep into this, right? He's also launched his own coin. He's doing a hell of a lot there, right? So in my book, I go, so actually crypto is a little bit like, there's just got that one little industry, which he has pledged to help. Everyone believes that he's going to help. The problem, as we've talked about quite a lot in the past, and it's a small asset class. But remember Bitcoin, which is what we're talking about. Bitcoin's worth, what, about $1.5 trillion US. Entire crypto industry is probably 2.5. NVIDIA, those companies alone are worth kind of 3. But those, just one company is worth kind of double what Bitcoin is. And so that's why it doesn't take much of changes in supply or demand of these assets for big movements in price. And with what he's promised, hopefully we should get quite a big increase in demand. Is why you're starting to see those moves, and I expect you're going to continue to see those moves over the coming weeks.
Yeah, it's always a different reason, but yeah, every 4 years we seem to see this pattern that just kicks off right about now, highly aligned to the election cycle, and it just goes ballistic. And if there is some sort of follow through with making Bitcoin some sort of strategic reserve, I think the impact of that could be quite phenomenal, because other nation states would quite possibly look at that and through the lens of a bit of game theory, thinking, well, we don't want to be left out of this. And hey, this is the way things are going. I think it's also quite interesting with the BRICS plus nations and trying to form some sort of new currency block, whether that is linked to gold or just a basket of those nation state currencies remains to be seen, I guess. But if that goes that way, then if the US somehow has some sort of strategic reserve, then it buys more time to allow the US dollar to be the world's reserve asset for a start, because it will restore faith in the ability of the U.S. government to pay its debts. And I think that is the issue that might be showing up in the bond market. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like the bond market is telling us that, hey, faith is dropping a little bit, but also there's inflation that the bond market is telling us is coming up. We've seen yields go up. So yields means that the price of bonds is going down, which means that it's going to be more expensive for the government to borrow, which is concerning. What do you think that is telling us, though? Yields going up in say, the 10-year, for example. What does that mean?
To me, it's an inflation story. Simple as that. I don't think the bond market. Yeah, I think there's a little bit of nervousness around the quantity around the edges. But to me, it's an inflation story. People are looking at tariffs. They're looking at tax policy and going, this is government deficits becoming more and more entrenched, more government borrowing. We've seen over the last 5 years, that drives inflation. So yeah, I think we're kind of starting to see this world of, actually, we're back to kind of the mid-2000s versus the 2010s, which is where I think everyone had been hoping we'd be going. To me, it's, yeah, inflation is where it's all at.
Yeah. So bringing that down to how it affects everyday people here in New Zealand, like the way that I would look at the rising bond yields, it just points to a little bit of an indicator that, yes, we might have locally here, we might have falling interest rates. But when we say we're going to have falling interest rates, we're talking about the official cash rate, which primarily affects the floating and the short-term fixed rates, like 1, maybe 2 years. And yes, that might come down. Thankfully, that's what most Kiwis do. They just fix for 1 or 2 years. She'll be right. No one really manages risk there. They just kind of go for the short term. And so it probably won't be too relevant. However, if you were in that space where you were thinking longer term and you were quite keen to hedge away some of the risks of rising interest rates because of a second wave of inflation, well, the cost for doing so might get more expensive if we continue to see these yields spike up, right? Because most of the interest rates are going to be influenced by these bonds rather than what's happening with our OCR. So do you see that there could be a situation where we have a very positive yield curve, or we have a very positive shape? The longer you fix it for, the more expensive it gets. You kind of, because right now it's flat, but
I do see that, because I do think I do firmly believe that the chances of inflation are growing by the day, and I think it's going to be hard for the US to keep inflation domestically focused and domestically centered. So yeah, I do think we are going to see a steeper yield curve. It's going to be driven by increasing expectations on inflation, to be honest. Plus, so what that will also mean is that we will expect, it's hard to unpick how much of it's future interest rate expectations versus term premium. Yeah, we are about to start seeing more and more of that in my book, because, yeah, interest rates, I don't think they're going to go too much lower than where they are right now, is the sad truth about it. Right.
Yeah, which is quite fascinating, because that is not the main story that people are hearing right now. No. Certainly the people that I'm talking to are under the belief that, hey, we're going back to normal, and normal being the last 4 years, right? So a lot of recency bias at play, in my view. And I hate to be saying that out loud, because it does sound quite negative and like party pooper time, right? I still also feel there's going to be quite a resurgence of the property market here in New Zealand, and people are going to be pretty optimistic, especially over summer. But I just don't see that necessarily sustaining itself throughout next winter and beyond, especially if we see that inflation is quite sticky here in New Zealand. I guess it's going to be limited as to how far things can go, because there's still stuff going down in the world that means we're kind of importing inflation as well. And there's only so much that can be done, right?
I mean, I think one of the things that we'll have here, right, is an austerity will mean that we will be, domestically, we will be deflationary, but we will be importing inflation. So that'll be the balance that we have to figure out, right? So, yeah, I think increasingly where I get to on the inflation argument, it's all down to the government. Every government spending sits, and whether we're surplus deficit, whether we are there, that's what's going to drive whether we sit in high inflation or low inflation.
Sure. I heard this fantastic quote from one of my heroes, Milton Friedman. Of course, he's my hero. All government spending is tax. I think that was what he was saying. All government spending is effectively tax, either via inflation or via tax. It's tax. Like, there's absolutely zero that government does. Like, I love that, because it is just so pure right-wing truth, you know? Which, of course, I'm not a Trump supporter. But it just kind of speaks to, like, the strategy that Trump is using, that our current government here in New Zealand kind of used to imply that we're going to get things out of the system a little bit here. We're going to flush out too much government out of the system, reduce government spending, shrink the size of it, massive amounts of side effects with that, of course. But we're going to shrink the size because we recognize that that is inflationary. That creates the ability for us to lower taxes, which is inflationary, and it also paves the way for the Reserve Bank to lower interest rates. So it's interesting to see that that is a similar strategy that's being adopted in the United States as well, or at least that's what they're saying, that taxes are dropping, government is shrinking.
And I got no issue with that, right? But I think it requires an honest conversation about where and how you cut, right?
Yeah.
To be honest, can't, got no issue with a smaller government. I got no issue with us kind of stopping things. Let's not beat around the bush, right? If we want to cut our budgets and we want a smaller government, it means universal healthcare. It means we can't pay universal superannuation to everyone. It means education has to change. There's a whole lot of these things that need to change, and I've got no issue with that conversation, but let's have it. Let's not pretend that we can have our cake and eat it too.
Yeah. I think there's like a little bit of a cake that you could eat though. Just a little biscuit or like a little, you know, just at least a forkful of cake, because like, if you think about it, you're a business owner as well. So you know what it's like if you're trying to increase your net profit. You look at some of your operations and you go, right, well, that's not actually adding value. It's a nice to have. It's making someone feel good. Oh. Great. But you know, there's that. Households do that as well. So I don't think it's instantly, hey, if we reduce government spending, we're actually going to get less for it. I think there is probably a little bit of fat that could be trimmed without it actually affecting output too much. Am I being unreasonable with that, though, in your view?
Look, I think it's a good starting spot to try and hit, right? I think this is a conversation for next week, but I do think as our population demographic changes, our government expense lines change, we are trying to do the same things with the same amount of money, right? And sure, that's the real challenge. So I personally, I'm a big believer that our aging population is going to mean that actually the whole structure of our economy, the whole structure of where and how we spend money has to change. Because at the moment, well, when our current system of healthcare and superannuation came in, we had 15 workers for every person over the age of 65. We're currently sitting at 4 workers for everyone over the age of 65. In 20 years' time, that's going to be 2. Healthcare, right? Universal healthcare. We've got a great healthcare system. 45% of our healthcare budget is spent on people over the age of 65, despite the fact they make up 17% of the population. Yeah. There's just a whole lot of stuff like that that I go, doesn't make sense. We can't assume that we can just keep on doing all of this same stuff and actually the inputs are materially changing.
Yeah. Demographics are destiny. And also, I guess, speaks to a longer term trend, right? Where there's going to be greater and greater inequality. And some of that will come about because our government at some stage will have to acknowledge the reality that it cannot keep up with superannuation contributions at the rate that they always have been without means testing, perhaps. And maybe medical services, public health care, those days are numbered in terms of how free it can be for how long, sadly. Maybe even education might need to actually get back down to the basics. Personally, I think that's great. Let's just get back to reading, writing, and maths. But that's kind of also something that needs to happen. Luckily, I know that technology can handle that, but as it comes down to like the everyday investor in their household trying to plan ahead for their future, things like medical insurance, thinking about schooling for your kids, other alternative education options if you can afford it, and then thinking about just investing, because if we're relying on whatever it is, $20,000 a year coming from the government in the form of superannuation and retirement, is that really a reasonable thing for us to be doing? That's why I think it's just so important that we figure out a way to be investing somewhere up to 10% of our income from the age of 30 onwards so that we actually are taking care of ourselves. Because I don't think it's reasonable anymore for us to rely on government. Well, from my generation downwards, I don't think that's reasonable for us to actually think like that anymore. And for the reasons that you've just touched on there as well, I really don't think our expectations are calibrated correctly for the future. Tis what it is. But on that bombshell, we've covered a ton of ground. Hey, that's cool.
We started in the US and finished out in New Zealand.
Yeah. What a good way to be. And we're looking forward to a whole bunch of Democrats that are moving here now because they threatened to leave if we'll have them. Because Trump's in. But I'm not expecting to see too many of them. I think they're gonna love that in Orange. Yeah. Yeah, he's a lovely guy, you know, Donald Trump. You just have to listen to a couple of hours of him on Joe Rogan, and you'll discover he's just a regular Muppet of a man who's made some mistakes in the past, but don't hate him because of his hair and his orange skin color. Yeah, he'll make America great again. We'll see. Yeah, I didn't bring my mega hat. Cool, man. All right, we'll see you. We'll see you next week if you'll have me back on and you don't get too
much. We'll definitely see you next week. You'll have your mega hat and you'll be running to be the next, Shane Jones.
There we go. I want to get thank you. I want to get a tinfoil mega hat, you know? Wouldn't that be cool? It just kind of encapsulates everything.
It'd be amazing.
Yeah, because like if you keep on going right far enough, conspiracy theories merge with right wing politics, and according to the left, anyway. And so it just seems appropriate, right? Like that's what I'm expecting for my Christmas present this year from you, Rupert.
Don't worry, I can get my kids to make you a tinfoil hat with MAGA written on front. We'll be there.
There we go. Cool, man. All right, good chat though. We'll catch up with you next week.
Okay. Well, thank you, Darcy, and I'll speak next week.
Sounds good. Cheers.
Thanks. Bye.